You're listening to TCRG to CEO Radio with your host, Courtney J., TCRG.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to TCRG to CEO Radio. I'm your host, Courtney J., TCRG, and I'm so glad to have you back for another week's episode. This episode is very special and dedicated to the late Maureen McTaggart Hall on behalf of Jason Hayes, who is our guest today. And also special with this episode is I wanted to do something for our Irish dancing community that has been impacted by some of the recent debates over transgender dancers, as well as honor Jason's community over at the Trevor Project. So in honor of Jason and all of our Irish dance community, we are going to collect the number of listens that this episode receives in the first week. So up until it'll be February, let's see, gotta get our calendar up here, through February 21st, every listen that records on my analytics, I will donate a dollar on behalf of Jason in his name to the Trevor Project. So if you want to find out more about the Trevor Project, I will leave the link in the episode show notes, and I will share the analytics on my Instagram story so you guys know the contribution we were able to make. And I'm really happy to do that on behalf of this amazing community and for Jason and all of our other dancers that are supported by the work that the Trevor Project does. So without further ado, here is our episode with the one and only two-time world champion, Jason Hayes. Today we have with us Jason Hayes, who really needs no introduction, but I'm going to let him tell us all about him, and welcome Jason to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. And again, sorry about the voice. If I sound a little weird, allergies are kind of getting to me.
So tell us how you got into dancing in the first place.
Yes. So I know you and I, Tyler, we're, you know, same age. I'm not going to share how old we are. but, you know, I like to say, you know, I am the Riverdance generation, the Lord of the Dance generation. I remember this so distinctly, Riverdance Live from New York on PBS. Neighbors of ours had a copy of Feet of Flames. I was obsessed watching it. And I told my parents, this is what I have to do. So growing up in Fort Worth, Texas, you know, you really don't think Irish dancing in Fort Worth. Well, my parents rented How to Irish Dance videos by Colin Dunn. There's a video. Literally rented it from the local, from our public library. I watched that for hours on end. And eventually my mom found the McTaggart Irish dancers. They, at the time, didn't have their own studio space, but they were renting out of the local Catholic high school and showed up. And that the day I happened to show up was the day that Maureen McTaggart Hall was in town. And if anyone is familiar with Maureen Hall, rest in peace, she would, you know, travel to all her different locations. And it was a big deal when she was in town. So my very first practice was with Maureen Hall.
Aww.
And at one point, she looked over to one of the teaching assistants and asked, like, how long has this boy been dancing? And they're like, this is his first day. And I think I learned all my soft shoe dances. I learned like a two hand and a three hand. At one point, Mrs. Hall had to tell me to literally sit down because I wouldn't stop dancing. And let's see, that was in May of 1999.
Wow.
And I was obsessed. I was hooked. 6 months later, I competed at my very first fest where I won 6 out of my Southern dances. And then a year after that, December 2000 is when I won my first Aroctus title.
That's incredible. So obviously you were very talented right from the start.
I like to say, you know, I took to dancing like a fish takes to water. You know, when people talk about, you know, natural ability, I was one of those that really had a natural ability for dancing. Of course, that still came with like a lot of hard work.
Of course. I mean, and looking back, your parents were probably really lucky that McTaggart was even in Fort Worth. Like, you think about how Irish dancing really went through a big development at that time, with the Riverdance generation now going out and starting schools. And, you know, Texas is obviously a huge, huge place. It wasn't somewhere that was typically rich in Irish dancing. So it's really a happy, you know, occurrence that they were even there.
It is, honestly, it is incredible. Because, yeah, you know, if you think about it on a global scale, you know, Texas does have quite a significant Irish immigrant population, but when you think dance, Irish dancing, Texas is not, well, was not the first place you thought of. I mean, country two-stepping for sure, and, you know, rodeos. Like, when you think cowboys, you think Texas.
Yeah. Now, with so many Irish dancers coming to Texas, you know, really your hometown of sorts, you know, with Grapevine, I don't know how far Grapevine is from you right now, but what are some of your must-sees for everyone heading to the North Americans?
Yes. So I just want to selfishly proclaim that when I was still involved with dancing, it was my idea for Southern region to host here in Grapevine, Texas. So Grapevine is smack dab in the middle of DFW. Literally, it's 20 minutes from Dallas, 20 minutes from Fort Worth. So, and I've actually been creating some proposals for the co-chairs. I will say your must-do, the shopping here is incredible. Right next to the Gaylord, you have the Grapevine Mills Outlet Mall in South Lake Town Square. So some like really top brands are out there. Vineyard Vine, Kendra Scott, H&M, you know, all the favorites are there. If you want to venture further out to North Park, that's where your designer brands are. If you are want to take in more of the sights and sounds, you got to go to the Fort Worth Stockyards. You can actually take the train from Grapevine directly into the Stockyards, and that's where the cattle drives used to come through. It is, and you can even still see a cattle drive happening daily in the Fort Worth Stockyards. The Fort Worth Zoo and Dallas Zoo, they are some of the top ranked in the nation. And of course, you know, we have, where we are one of the few places that actually have major league sports, like actually host all of them. So you can go check out a football game at AT&T Stadium, go watch the Texas Rangers at Globe Life Park, watch the Dallas Mavericks at the American Airlines Center, or if hockey, you can also see the Dallas Stars at the American Airlines Center. And of course, we have the original Six Flags Park. So if you want to get your thrills, go to Six Flags over Texas.
Oh,
and
amazing. Also, see, glad I asked. Yeah.
Yep, and of course, this is Texas. The weather is definitely, it's going to be 100 degrees, so like 30 Celsius. It's going to be hot, so make sure you drink a ton of water. Bring a lot of suntan lotion, but make sure that you do get outside because the weather is going to be hot, but it's going to feel amazing.
Awesome. And will you be making an appearance at the North Americans?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Grapevine is about 20 odd, like 20-ish minutes from my apartment. Yeah, I will be there every day.
Okay, great. So back to your own dancing career. It wasn't bad. Yes. Not bad.
Not bad. Not quite bad.
So actually, tell us a little bit, you know, beyond that first Aractas, you know, you went out and won and that trend pretty much continued, right?
Yes. So you know, it's funny. You always get asked this question, like right off, like read off your dancing title. So yes, I competed for about 16 years. I won 14 undefeated Southern Aractus titles, 2 North American titles, the All Ireland, and 2 World Championship titles. And I actually hold the distinction of being the first dancer from the Southern region to have ever won the world. As of now, I'm the only dancer from the Southern region to have won it twice. I think that will change possibly this year, or very much in the near future. But also a weird fact, I think if I am correct, I also hold the distinction of having the longest gap between
yes.
world titles.
I was going to ask you about that because it's incredible, obviously, to win the worlds once, even more incredible to win it twice. But I think there's something to be said about winning titles with a gap in the middle. It's like 8 years, right? 2006 and 2014.
Yes.
Which is
like... I happened to win both times the Winter Olympics were on TV.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool too. I mean, so you're in completely different phases of your life in those moments.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what it was like pursuing that second title or what it was like in that gap?
Yeah, so I just want to say this, and for everyone listening, please understand what I'm saying is that, you know, a lot of people can win the world once. Now, what I mean is that if you look at the list of people who have won the world championships one time, it is, you know, quite an extensive list, especially in the 50 years the world championships have been around. But if you start looking at who's winning multiple titles, that list is smaller. And I think, you know, as dancers, you know, we do put a lot of pressure on ourselves. You know, winning once, it is an accomplishment in itself. But
right, it's a dream.
Absolute dream. But, you know, everyone wants to try to win multiple, but there is a different kind of pressure when you win. You know, I won my very first title when I was 14. I was in the boys under 15. So then in my head, it's okay, I only have X number of years left to try and get another title. And that pressure does build up on you. And then going into other worlds, you know, I didn't do bad. I still placed top five, fourth. You know, I still did well, but in my head, I wasn't winning.
Right.
And so it was hard to juggle the fact that I felt like I wasn't accomplishing what I wanted. Yet, you know, you're people. I'm achieving placements that people wish they could. But through it all, it really told me. It helped me get perseverance to really, you know, still believe in myself, still push myself. And, you know, sometimes, and I had to kind of deal with the fact, you know, I'm not going to win every year. People aren't going to win every year, but if I could focus on my own dancing and being happy with how I dance, that's what I can control. And that's something that I would tell my students is, you know, you can't control the judge's opinion about you, but you can control your dancing and how you feel about it. So I won't lie, it didn't take until I was almost into the senior men's that I finally really just held on to that of you know what, I'm going to be happy with how I'm dancing. I'm going to focus with what I'm doing and feel great with the package I'm presenting. And, you know, screw what the judges think. They might like me, they might not. But if I can still walk out that stage being happy with how I dance, then that's all that matters. So all of that to say is that, you know, a lot of ups and downs. Many times at one point I just thought about stopping dance altogether just because, you know, I just felt like I wasn't worth it, but it's just struggling.
Yeah.
So, the coffee's kind of kicking in. I felt kind of gibberish.
I mean, I grew up watching, you know, this age group, and I wish I could go and, you know, replay any of those worlds of watching you and Tyler Schwartz and Fergal Keeney. There were so many amazing dancers. It was always such a dynamic competition to watch.
Yes. I must say, you know, kind of getting back, you know, we're the Riverdance generation. And I think the 89 to 93 years, those are, I think, some of the greatest dancers ever. All of us that were born between 1989 to 93, some of the best dancers, my age group, those 91 boys, we had, four different world champions, our top five, and it was always a gamble who was going to be in the top five because we had so many strong boys. And so it might be the same five dancers up there, but it was never the same winner. And actually, in my age group, all of us, I think all of the boys won a collective just two North American titles because none of us were able to win more than that.
Yeah.
Because it just kept changing.
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, anyone who didn't get to watch it in real time is out of luck because no Fesh TV these days, but absolutely incredible. I mean, and do you think anything would have been, you know, different, or how do you feel like social media and Fesh TV and all of these modern inventions have changed Irish dancing?
So I just want to say, you know, we had the OG live streaming where it's just simply the back of
the blog with the pictures.
Yeah, the backstage, as we're giving shout outs. It's so funny how now we are actually able to watch full competitions. I think the rise of social media. So I just as a caveat, I work in marketing and I actually have quite a large Instagram following through a separate brand. So I study this. I understand these metrics. I understand this algorithm and essentially how you create a following. And of course, you know, how you share information. I think social media has become very interesting in regards to Irish dancing. I recall when I won my last world title, 2014, I think that was kind of when Instagram was becoming more popular. It was still in a relevant infancy. You know, we were still using filters built in with a square ratio. But I remember at the time you had a lot of those kind of fan accounts, you know, there's the Instagram accounts for these dancers. And it was cute. It was fun. I actually, some of my friends made one for me before I went off to train for the world. And it was a nice confidence boost. But now I feel it's become a bit weird, especially seeing these fan accounts for dancers that are minors. I know Una Harrigan had commented that it's creepy. And I do agree. Another thing I have found very interesting with the rise of social media, especially with things like TikTok, Instagram Reels, is, you know, when you're seeing videos of these top dancers, especially now with Fesh TV able to screen record and publish, is I felt there's a rise of a homogeneity of dance. And I felt there for a while. If you look, no matter what school, everyone seemed to be dancing alike. It was very weird. I feel now post-COVID, it kind of moved away from that. But for a while there, I think because kids would see like, oh, this top dancer is doing this. So if I do this movement, that means I'm going to place well. And I think some schools kind of jumped on that mindset. So yeah, for a while there, I would be at a fest or just at a major. And I'm like, I just saw five different dancers from five unaffiliated schools, yet their steps looked almost copy-pasted.
Yes, because they were doing all these similar things. The last Worlds.
Yeah. It's like I said, it's kind of moved away from that. But now I feel you have some schools that have veered so far from that to make themselves look unique and identifiable that they have a very, I'm going to say that they have a style that I don't find attractive, but it's working for them. Or you have some schools that have been leaned so heavily into that we're just going to keep doing what our dancers can do well. And so they're almost hitting this point of, yes, your basics are fantastic, but your material is relatively boring. I think there is a way to have a fine line of, you know, still making yourself unique, still making yourself relevant. But I guess to kind of bring it back to your question of social media and Irish dancing, from an internal look from the Irish dance world, I don't think it's really benefited us quite a way that I think it could have. But from an external view, I think it has been fantastic as to getting more people aware of what Irish dancing is, especially when you have, I think it's Carta, the boys
in Ireland.
I mean, I'll say this, the show dancing is not my cup of tea, but what they've done for Irish dancing, it's what Riverdance did for us. You know, it's inspiring all these new kids to try it out because they see it on a platform that's accessible to them. So yeah, so internally, social media, I guess kind of a double-edged sword. Externally, social media has been fantastic for Irish dancing.
Yeah, that was a great, like, comprehensive look into all that. Now, do you feel like, you know, I think you're a great person to ask about this because you were the Southern region's first ever world champion, which I'm sure was a great honor, a huge, you know, privilege of sorts. But then from that point on, you are known as, oh, that's Jason Hayes. He's the world champion. He's our, you know, one and only. And I can imagine that probably comes with a lot of pressure also.
Yes. Pretty much my identity was Jason Hayes, the world champion.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining about that. I achieved a level of success that is incredibly unique in our sport. And I'm very proud of my accomplishments. I worked so hard to achieve this, but yet it came with now being, to be part of like this upper echelon of accomplishment, you're kind of now part of a club, like the world champion club, for lack of a better term. But it is a very lonely feeling and it's a very confusing feeling. So, and what I mean by that is, you know, if you look at other regions, you know, especially in England, Ireland, you know, they dominated for the earliest years of the world championship. And so, you know, you have these regions that, yes, produce world champion year after year after year. So the culture and the mindset is already established. Where these schools, where these teachers, they know how to train world champions, but they know how to take care of world champions as far as their mental health, emotions, you know, just dealing with that additional pressure. Being from the South, I was told, I remember hearing from growing up, is that the Southern region will never have a world champion. Like, we just did not have the caliber of dancing. We just didn't have the talent, which is, very true. If you look at the earliest years of the Southern region, we never produced top dancers. I think there was a one-off where we had maybe a national title, but, you know, Southern region dancers weren't world medal holding, barely even recalling. So to be the first world champion, yes, it's, you know, a huge accolade to say I was the first from an entire region, but because we didn't have the culture, the mindset already established there, it was hard because I was, in a sense, now kind of navigating this new path of being a world champion by myself. I mean, even my teachers, you know, they did their best. They even, they had never produced a world champion before. They had good dancers, but they never had anyone that had reached a level that I had. So it was difficult. And yeah, there was that pressure of being the only world champion, which I wore with a badge of pride, and I still do. But looking back on it now, I do wish that maybe some more people had maybe stepped up or maybe offered some more guidance to say, hey, this is kind of now what's going to happen afterwards. Yes, you're going to feel more pressure every single year. You're going to want to do all these additional things. It comes with its own unique,
challenges, I'm sure.
Yeah, that. Thank you. Yeah, challenges. Because now there's the pressure of wanting to repeat your success. There's now this pressure of where you are essentially labeled the best dancer, not just in the world, but in your entire region.
Yeah.
And that's the non-negotiable. Like, yes, I literally was the best. It's a very odd feeling. And I think now, because the South has produced more and more talent, I mean, it's incredible. I was at the Southern Rockets in Dallas back in December, and I was floored by just how good the dancing was. And I think it's insane how I remember I saw this girl. She was like top two at the North Americans, but she got fifth at our Rockets, which I think is just, because I remember like when we grow up, it was like, okay, if you place a certain way at a major, you're pretty much guaranteed to place a good way at the Rockets. But now it doesn't matter how well you did at a major earlier in the year, you're Rockets. I'm glad that it comes down to the day of. But all in all, to say it, I just wish now that I did have a bit more support, or maybe some other, former world champions to say, hey, congratulations on this accomplishment. If you are struggling mentally, or you kind of feel a bit lost, or don't quite know what you're doing now, I'm here to help. And actually, so in 2016, when the Southern Region got its next world champions, Sierra DuBois and Jackson Loyson, when they won, I actually emailed them, like going into the 2017 world, pretty much telling them what I wish I had been told.
That's really good.
They're both really good friends of mine, amazing dancers. But I told them, you've won a world title, that's amazing, but now here's the difficulty of trying to win again. And no one talked about just how much pressure it is, but how much that pressure is coming from you. Yeah. The rest of the world doesn't care. Your teachers would love to see you win, but they want to see you dance well, because we know you can't control what happens on the day. Your competition doesn't want you to win because they want to win.
Yeah.
So it's all in your head. And that's what I told them, is that, you've done the damn thing. You won a world title. But, and I also reminded them that you already have that playbook. Because you've won, you now know what you have to do to win another. You understand all the hard work it takes. You understand the corrections that had to be implemented. And you listen to your teachers, and you listen to the people who love and care about you. So just do that again. It's not going to guarantee a first place, but it will guarantee that you will be happy.
And that's really the most important thing. Who cares how many worlds you've won if if your mental health is suffering for the rest of your life afterwards?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's amazing that you reached out to them and, that you still have a great relationship with them to this day. I think that probably means a lot to them. Could you feel the momentum in the Southern region building from that first world title? Because it is true that the Southern region has continued to get better and better and better every year.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. So I don't know what it is, but I'm a sponge for Irish dance knowledge and history. I think that's kind of like a weird thing. All of us collectively have the Irish dance world. It's a fun fact we remember. So yeah, Southern region, our very first Aroctus was 1997. And I know prior to that, all dancers in the South competed up in the Mid-Atlantic. And it wasn't until about, 96, 97, that a Southern region was created. So the very first national title, if I remember right, was won by Whitney Rondeau. And she danced for her mom. She was based in Florida. That was 2003. And then you had the likes of Megan Harper, who used to dance for Kevin Brosler. She won in 2006. 5. And so that was, again, that was kind of like what the only major things were. So then I won my first world title in 2006. And really from there is, yeah, things just kind of slowly progressed in 2009, you had Jessie Baffa. She won the All-Ireland, and she was the very first dancer from the South to win the All-Ireland. And then everything just kind of like blew up from there. It's suddenly more and more dancers from the South were world medal holding, getting top five, started winning major titles. And I actually would say probably into 2016, when Saoirse Dubois and Jackson Boyson, when they won the world, that's just when things really, really took off. Because I noticed a lot of teachers who were, say, immigrating from England or Ireland, they were now looking at the South to open up schools. One, because there's a lot of land out here, you know, cost of living is still relatively affordable. And with that, they brought their own experiences, their own talent, and that just changed the Irish dance landscape. We're really, I mean, if you look now at the World Championships, actually, I believe this past year, the Southern region had the most world medal holders or recallers out of every region.
Which is so incredible. I mean, the growth in such a short period of time.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely insane. I mean, like I said, I was at the Oireachtas, and it was such a treat to watch the likes of like Garrett Zagorski, the current, like the most recent Southern world champion. I saw his dancing, which was absolutely beautiful. But you also have Jack Porter, who was first going into the set round at the Worlds. He still got second, like beautiful dancing. And that's just like the boys, but you know, looking at the girls, like, my God, it's such a treat. There's that girl, Elise
Watson. Yeah, Elise Watson.
Yeah, she now dances for Michaela Hines. I got to see her. And again, she got top five at the All-Ireland. Like, she was just right off the podium of the world. It's to have that level of dancing here. I mean, it's kind of like, I love it, but like 15 years ago, it was almost unfathomable.
Right. Yeah. And I like how, you know, in recalling your own kind of history, like you had people that you did see achieve All-Ireland titles and nationals titles before you. So to be part of that fabric now of everyone going forward after you, I feel like is a really special thing, especially in a region where, you know, the little wins like that along the way have been so important.
Yeah. And I think I feel very fortunate that I got to compete here in the South, because that really was the mindset of, again, like I said earlier, being from the South, we were kind of told, you know, we'll never win a world championship. We just don't have that caliber. We don't have that talent. And, you know, major titles were just kind of far off. So whenever the South did accomplish something like that, or somebody from the South won, the entire region celebrated, because it was not just a win for this dancer, but it was a win for the Southern region. Because it was kind of like us saying that, hey, we do have this talent here. It may not be as abundant as other regions, but that talent is here and it is growing.
Absolutely. Now, to bring the social media part back to like current day, I can only imagine that the pressure and the, I don't know, like the feeling like the world is watching is even worse now, with social media being so, so prevalent, so highly used among really young dancers. I mean, it's frightening actually how young some of these kids are on social media, watching other or having accounts made for them. And I don't think they are even old enough to really understand what that means or might be putting on them. Can you speak to that a little bit?
It's I don't like it. Just gonna be pretty
I don't
blunt.
Either.
It's odd, and I feel now things are being made for the sake of content, where I don't think kids are understanding, you know, what it is they're posting, what it is they're sharing. I feel, and when we were growing up, you know, hell, I remember Zynga, MySpace,
Tumblr.
Do not get me started on the dance community and Tumblr. I'm sure I'm going to get some hate messages for that. But it was odd that I felt there was, because social media was so new, I do feel that we were sometimes more careful with what we posted. Because, you know, we would probably hear the rumors of, oh, such and such dancer got kicked out of their school because of what they posted or what they shared. And I don't hear as much about that now, probably because kids are a bit more savvy in understanding what they should and should not share or post online. But yeah, it's this weird rise of this idolization.
That's a good word. Idolization is a great word. Yes.
Yeah, I want to say, I think Una Harrigan said it in her episode, yep. And that just stuck. That yes, there's this weird idolization of talent. I'm not gonna say a sport dance or a specific person. It is our idolization of talent, which is, you know, that's not unique to Irish dancing. You know, think about the Olympics. Who do we look up to? Who gets the most coverage? It is the people with exceptional talent. Simone Biles, Michael Phelps, you know, the people that we recognize that, like, they are truly amazing people. But with that, yes, comes this weird idolization. And the fact that there are accounts essentially setting up dancers as young as 6, 7, 8. And I see those accounts sometimes pop up, and usually in the bio, it's like, this account is run by the parent.
Yeah.
To me, that doesn't make it better. That does not make it better. And these kids don't need to be seeing that. You know, yes, have your social media, but keep it on private. You know, don't be posting your steps, first of all, because kids, like, for any dancers that are listening, your steps are not your property. You know, it's an intellectual property. Your steps are owned by your teacher. They're owned by your school. And now, unless you have, like, a permission to post them, that's kind of what I said earlier, where I felt there's this homogeneity of Irish dancing, is because kids are posting their material. It's so easy to copy others. But because this is social media and you curate what you're posting, you're not only seeing the best dancing.
That's true.
Like that eight bars you recorded in class, that was the best dancing you ever did. Yeah, I'm gonna post that. But now you're creating this mindset of, like, you look like that all the time. And so if you go to a fesh and you don't dance like that, or you go to a major and you don't dance like that, well, then what's the truth?
Well, and that's the part I think is the double-edged sword, because I think the reason people get so caught up in posting or making accounts to promote themselves is exactly for that, hoping that by promoting yourself, you're going to achieve a better result. But the other side of that is, well, now everyone's seen your very best dancing online. So if you go out and you don't show up that way, that's not going to work in your favor. And this is going to be, I think, increasingly interesting as people our age start to become adjudicators. We're all existing in this same online space where we're seeing these videos. I just am on the edge of my seat waiting to see how this goes.
Yes. Agreed. You know, I was talking to some friends of mine at the Oroctus who are now adjudicators, and you know, we were talking social media, we were just catching up, but they brought up is, yes, you know, hiding the numbers online, you know, the dress reveals, you know, and we're kind of also talking about the cheating scandal, is in a, like, almost it doesn't matter, because our community, our world is so small. We know who these top dancers are. We know who these good, like, where the talent is. We know who to watch in these competitions. So this self-promotion, I think, is actually, it's hindering. It's not helpful. Because, yeah, you're right. As teachers, as adjudicators, we live in this shared community online.
Yeah.
Even if you are a teacher and you don't have a personal account, but you run your school account, you're still seeing the same content. You're still seeing these other dancers. And yeah, you are setting yourself up as that if you do not look like that practice video that you posted, or you keep reposting the same step from that world championships you did well at, you are now setting the precedent that you look like that all the time. And that's not reality.
Yep.
You are going to have good days. You are going to have bad days.
Yeah, I mean, just like everybody else.
Yeah, I'm a world champion. I can guarantee you, I did not dance like a world champion at every practice. Trust me, breaking in new shoes, my God, I look like a baby horse. Like, come on.
So to switch gears a little bit, you know, you win your second title in 2014.
Yes.
Did you know at that point in time, like, what your plan was going to be, or was it very fluid? You know, you have gone on to sit for your TCRG, your TC now. Like, what did that post 2014 journey look like?
Yeah, so I always knew in my head that 2014 was going to be my last year of competition. The original goal was to win 15 Oireachtas titles. That's actually what I was going for. but in 2013, I broke my foot prior to the Oireachtas, so I had to set that out. That's its own hurt, is having to sit out of a competition, especially one that I love so much, which was the Oireachtas. But hey, it paid off. I mean, foot healed, moved to England, won a world title. So
yeah,
it was worth taking the break. So 2014, I always knew, like, this is where I want to end. And to be quite honest, like, so 2014 Oireachtas finishes. Already people are asking me, am I going to go for the 2015 Worlds in Montreal? And I remember telling people, I was like, I'm done. Like, every desire to compete left. I was like, you know, I've won the senior world title. I've won my 14th Oireachtas. It's like, I've done so much. I just want to stop and just kind of take a break. I was still in college. I was like, I just want to finish school. I just kind of want to enjoy being in school, being with my friends. And like, I just need to take a break from this. So I still kept up and did solos in 2015, 2016 for the Oireachtas. And I originally had wanted to do an exam in 2016, but I missed the deadline because I had sent my paperwork to Maureen Hall to sign when she was still with us. I'm just going to forewarn getting talking about TC when we get there. I'm probably going to get a bit emotional because it's going to talk about Maureen Hall. So missed the cutoff. I think it was for an exam in Phoenix. So I was in the first wait list to get into an exam in DC in February, which, I'll be honest, I am so glad that I missed that cutoff because it gave me so much additional time to study for my TC and going into that. Because I was actually listening to your episode where you said that you spent like 9 months prepping. I was the same. Yeah. And I love how you were saying in your episode that you were just kind of bursting at the seams to just get the exam over with because you just had all this knowledge that you just had to spill out on paper.
Yep.
Yes. That was me. That was me. I recall sitting down for the written exam. And so for everyone that's listening, when you sit down for the written, at least in my year, we read through all the questions. The examiners were up front. There's a whole room of us. And they're like, okay, we're going to read through these questions so you know. And I'll be honest, like as I started reading, I was just getting giddier and happier because I knew every answer. Because I was just had all that knowledge.
It's and now, the best feeling.
That was a great feeling. But then cut to like 5 months later, and I was running class. I'm like, oh, I'll teach the kids the fairy reel, which is actually one of the Kaylees I had to teach. And I'm like, I know this. I study for it. The first move is, and I went to grab the book. So I think it's so funny. It's like, yeah, we have all that knowledge. But yeah, once the exam's over, I could not tell you a single thing.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, you know, no matter what happened in 2014, you were ready to kind of move on to that next chapter. And it speaks to something that, like, I know I say to my dancers, which is like, you know, when you're done, you know, when you're ready to move on. And if you feel like you're not ready, then you're probably not. But if you're ready to go, I know it was the same for me, then you can feel at peace with retiring or moving on to that next chapter or, you know, enjoying life outside of dancing for the first time ever.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, there were times where I'm like, oh man, I kind of wish that I had done these competitions in 2014 or maybe gone in 2015, but that's looking back where I'm older and, you know, time has separated it. But y'all, I can say in 2014, 2015, no, I was done. And I was like, yeah, I just had no desire to compete because, I mean, I was like, I accomplished these huge things and I just didn't want to deal with the even like the more enormous pressure of trying to win another title, especially in a senior competition where as you're getting older, your competition's getting younger.
Right.
Because everyone's moving up. And I'm like, I don't need this. I wanted to end on a high note and I was very fortunate that I got to. So I was not going to change any of that.
Now, in that initial, you know, post-Worlds, did you have any, like, whiplash of, like, wait, this has been my whole life. I've just worked so hard to win this second title, and now it's done.
You know what? No.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah, thinking back on it, no. So if people don't know, for the 2014 world, I actually took my spring semester off of college and I moved to England and I got to train with Rose Ellis of Shauna Aaron, because at the time she was doing our choreography. And that, you know, that was a huge thing. That's just still when very few dancers from the US and Canada, there were some dancers who had, you know, moved overseas to train with other schools. And it was still kind of an unheard of thought, but I feel now it's more common. So I made that big sacrifice and obviously it paid off. But yeah, just afterwards, I won the world. I think the biggest whiplash was more like, oh my God, I did it. And this globe that's sitting in my room, that's real. Like, this isn't made up. Like, that actually happened. And yeah, and again, because winning the senior world is such a huge accolade. It's a big deal. It's the only age group that you receive the globe and the original Rose Bowl, like that dates back to the first world championships. I cannot tell you the amount of names that was on that bowl. It's such a stellar list of dancers. I guess the whiplash was more like, wow, I did it. And this is how I get to end my career, really, is on the highest of highs.
Yeah.
And no one gets to take that away from me.
Yeah, it's true. That's great. I'm happy to hear that, because I feel like for a lot of people, they kind of go through a period of time where they feel a little bit lost of like, wait, I've done this thing my whole life and now I'm not doing it. And like, now what? And what was the transition, I guess, from dancer to TC to what you're doing now? What does that look like?
Well, that's going to actually sound more like what you're wanting to talk about.
Yeah.
Yes. So I sat my TC in February 2017, got my results in May, passed, thank God. And so I think a lot of people that get their TC, you are already in some kind of teaching capacity leading up to that. If you have to be, because you have to be essentially practicing being a teacher leading up to the exam. And you also need to start developing your own teaching style. So I was helping run classes, I was leading the champion class, helping the beginners. So I already knew what I was doing. And so that transition wasn't too hard going from dancer to teacher, because I was already coaching. But what was hardest is as a teacher, it's such a different mindset and it's such a different level of stress, because now we're as a dancer, you know what you can control, you know what your talent level is, you know what movements you can and cannot do. But as a teacher, you're now you're putting a lot of trust in somebody else, and that brought on a whole different level of stress and anxiety that I was not prepared for. And to be very honest, I was quite miserable at times. I was kind of hitting a point where I'm like, I really do not enjoy teaching. I don't like this kind of stress. I felt like I was giving so much of myself into some dancers, into the school, but was not getting a lot in return. And then the COVID-19 pandemic happened, which I'm sure for a lot of the ADs and TCs that are listening, I think we all kind of had a shared mindset or kind of the same experience of what is about to happen, but what is going to happen with my relationship with dancing? Because I talked with a lot of teachers around the same time. I quit. I stopped dancing. I stopped teaching in October 2020. But I remember hearing about a lot of other teachers and ADs doing the same thing. And I think the pandemic was a weird blessing, and that people could use that as the excuse to leave. To say, you know, like, unfortunately, the pandemic shut down my school, or it's taken away opportunities, or, you know, I have to refocus. I think it took away the guilt of outright saying, I'm leaving dance because I don't want to be here. And when I made that announcement, I know it took a lot of people by surprise when I announced that I was stopping dancing. And afterwards, I did have some teachers reach out to me to say, you know, hey, I'm in a similar situation. You know, how did you deal with it? What did you do? What was your mindset? And I was able to, you know, provide some assistance and some guidance. You know, this was my experience. Because at the end of the day, I was just unhappy. I was very miserable. I was trying to find a job, which is, you know, impossible because we had no idea what the world was going to look
right.
like not like the next day, or we didn't even know what the next month was going to look like. And I did not like that the thing that I grew up loving and was so passionate about was bringing me pain and making me sad. So I had to physically separate myself. So I moved away from Dallas, Fort Worth. I lived in Austin for about a year and a half. Still kept up with dancing more and doing just social media, Besh TV. And now that's kind of where my relationship is. I'm no longer involved with Irish dancing. I live in
a professional
Dallas,
capacity, I guess.
Yeah, in a professional capacity. Yeah, because I'm still watching all the dance videos. I'm still on Fesh TV. I'm still following like all the Irish dance accounts. But now I can sit back and actually enjoy our sport as a spectator, but also as a former participant. But I don't have to worry about the added stress of running a school, which I, just as a side note, I've always hated when people are like, you're just running a school. No, you're running a school.
You're not just running a school. And I think every listener of the podcast knows that.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. I mean, at my peak, when I was teaching, I was working a full-time job. So I was literally in an office from 8 to 5. Then I'd be going to teach dance usually from 6 to 9 p.m. in the evenings on Tuesday, Thursdays. On Saturdays, I'm teaching 5 hours of classes. On Sundays, I'm teaching private lessons. I'm trying to like get my own workouts in. I didn't have a life and it wasn't fun. And
yeah.
I'm like, this isn't what I want to be doing. And for being a gay man, I always kind of felt like I had to be even more cautious of what I was doing, what I was posting, just because of this stigma associated with men working with like teaching children. And so I just kind of felt like this, always kind of scared about that. So once I was able to separate and actually kind of just enjoy my life, I'm much happier. But again, I can now say I can actually enjoy dancing as a spectator and as somebody who really respects our sport because I participated. But as of now, I sometimes have that inkling to come back. I think I would like to be an adjudicator, but I'm not there yet. And I really appreciate when I was at the Aractus, I spoke to some current 80s and teachers who I knew had taken breaks from dancing for extended periods and then came back. And for everyone that is in listening, that is kind of in that boat, it is okay to take a break from dance. It will always be here. You can always come back to it, but you have to really enjoy your life and you have to achieve your, like, whatever success looks like for you, and so that you can feel happy. I talked with Scott Porter. He told me he took a break from Irish dancing for about 15, 16 years.
Which feels like such
back.
A long time, but like in the scheme of life, it's just a break.
And now if you all look at him, you know, he has an incredibly successful dance school and his children are great dancers. Emma Burke, I spoke with her. Y'all, she went to law school and she's an attorney and she had a very successful law career. She did that for 10 years before she came back. So, you know, there's nothing wrong, you know, pursuing your education, pursuing a career, and then coming back to dance, because if you can be at a place where you're happy and then dance, it can actually be the thing that you enjoy, do that. And that's kind of the journey I'm on. Like, long story short, that's the journey I'm on. I'm just enjoying this, kind of finding my own success and just what's bringing me happiness that's not dancing.
I think this is a really important topic and one that hasn't been discussed on the podcast before. And given it is a podcast about Irish dance professionals, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people listening either aspire to be a TC or aspire to be a studio owner, or they are in that situation. And I think it's really important to shed some light on what if you do all this stuff and you find out that you actually don't like it? And
yes.
That
yes.
You have an out. And something I was just talking to someone about recently was, you know, that if you do have a studio or a school, like you do need an exit strategy, and no one likes to think about their exit strategy. And obviously if you own your own school, you need a pretty well executed exit strategy, because you can't just put your sign on the door saying, hey, we're closed. You know, if you're teaching for someone else, maybe it's a little bit easier, but you still have attachments to those kids. And, you know, the people that you did, like you said, you put so much time and effort into, and, you know, it's not an easy decision, but it's also one that you can make, you can choose something different. Are you able to pinpoint, and you talked about them a little bit more broadly, the aspects that you really did not enjoy as a teacher?
Yes. I like I said, exit strategy. So I feel growing up, we were kind of the only options for growing up, if you want to continue Irish dancing, was you become a TC and or you get into the shows.
Yep.
There's really no discussion of a third option, which is, well, it was there. It was like you quit dancing, but I felt that was always just dripping with disdain. It's like, oh, you're going to quit. Like it. And so that was something I feel, you know, people wanted to avoid, or it was, you know, or there were a lot of negative feelings attached to that. It's like, oh, you're just going to stop. Like, how dare you? But yeah, it's kind of, to answer your question, the where I can pinpoint the aspects of dancing, like of teaching, that I did not like is, again, it's suddenly, I knew what I could do. I knew if I practiced for this amount of time, if I focused on improving these things, then my result will probably be this, or I can expect scores of this kind. It's like, you know, X plus Y equals Z kind of thing. But as a teacher, you are now having to, you're working with somebody else who's their own individual person, and trust and hope that the corrections you're giving them, the guidance and teaching you're providing them, that it will click, and that on the day, everything you've worked, they will actually do. Because I think we all of us teachers have had an experience of, you know, in the studio, you have that student, you know, they're great, you know, everything's looking good, but the day of a competition, it was like months and months of all that practice was just thrown out the window. And it could be for the silliest thing of what bothers them, or just kind of like the excuses for why. And that was very hard for me. And just because, you know, as teachers, we care about our students. I still have great relationships with some of my former students, actually. I still keep up with them. You know, they're all in college. They're all about to graduate. They're doing great things. And I care about them because, you know, we get to see these kids growing up.
Yeah.
And so the part of me is like, you know, I care about y'all deeply. I want you to be successful. It's just so hard to not see you do the thing I want you to do. And just could not stomach that. I remember one national, I think it was the 2017 Nationals in New Orleans, and watching one of my dancers, and oh my God, I just had like knots in my stomach. I could barely watch her dancing, and she did fine, but it just wasn't the quality of dancing that was used from her. And I'm like, I was miserable. I'm like, and just so stressed out. And that was kind of like, I'm like, that's not good. And then a couple years later, just having students not do well at an Aroctus, and I was devastated. Because I just knew how hard these kids had worked. And, you know, I thought like, you know, their dancing was great, but unfortunately the results didn't go the way we wanted. And again, I was just heartbroken for them. And that was kind of around the time I was like, this isn't fun.
The emotional roller coaster. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As a teacher, you're trying to then be, you know, a rock, because you can't be it's hard, you know, if you have two dancers on the day, one doesn't do well, but the other does well, you know, you have to be there for both of them.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the emotional roller coaster. Yes, you can be sad that the one dancer didn't get the result they wanted, but you can be happy for the dancer that did. So it's just all those, but you know, that's just competition. But yeah, to answer your question, I it was sad. It was having to trust and hope that somebody else would do the thing, like would do the corrections and the teaching and the steps the way I had worked with them, and just hope that they actually did it the day of.
Yeah, I think this is a really, you know, relatable feeling that I'm sure a lot of people out there, you know, they know what it feels like. They've been there, or they are now. And I think it's just important to talk about it and like remove some of that. Not that there's necessarily a stigma around that feeling, but like it doesn't get talked about. It doesn't get a lot of airtime. So
yeah.
No better place than here. So what do you feel like teachers and professionals in our industry can do to help dancers either transition through retirement or support their mental health? Or, you know, you had talked a lot about, you know, after winning that first Worlds that you just felt there was an element of support lacking for you in the way that you needed it.
Yeah. I this is something I will say. I do feel like the discussion around mental health has improved. Especially,
I think so too.
Yes, I do think post-pandemic, that was such a big topic, but mental health and how we take care of it. Simone Biles having to step out of the 2020 Summer Olympics, you know, that was such a big deal, but she cited that her mental health, she's like, I was, you know, she even said, I was putting myself in physical danger because of where my head was. So I think there's sort of a stigma now. And I think what teachers can do, if you have a kid, and actually this is something I just remembered, I remember I once had a student, she was injured. I didn't quite know. I knew she had an injury of some kind, but I didn't know to the severity. And her mom had to come up to me to say, hey, she's too afraid to tell you because she's worried that you'll be upset with her, but she has to set up this Aroctis because of her injury. And I'm like, one, I was like, oh, like, you know, I was upset because she was like looking really good. I hope she will qualify. But I was then so, I was just flabbergasted and just so upset at myself that I had to create this perception that my own students were afraid to tell me that they couldn't dance. And I'm like, that's not at all how I want to be as a teacher. And I really had worked to change a lot of my wording, what I was telling students, what I was like trying to create a culture of like, if you are injured, you've got to prioritize your health. So I think what teachers really need to be doing is paying attention to the words they are saying and also to the culture that they are creating within their schools and tell dancers, like, it's okay if, you know, you want to stop. You know, not everyone's journey looks like us as teachers that are continuing dancing for years and years and years. You know, some students, like I know kids, you know, they graduate high school and to them they're done because, you know, dance was just a thing they did as a kid. And, you know, college, if you've danced through college, you know how difficult that is. That's, you know, that's a big commitment. Or dancers, you know, who are just like, hey, you know, I've done all the things I want to do. And I don't want to go on any further. And that's okay. So I think it comes down to teachers, pay attention to what it is you are telling your students, acknowledging, you know, that there are more things to life than Irish dancing. You don't have to compete for the rest of your life. The shows are not for everyone. Me personally, I tried them. I did not like it. I was not a good, did not do well in shows. So that was that was an option for me, but that's okay as well. And for others, you know, being a TC, being a teacher, it's not the right thing. So I think nowadays, you know, we have like the rise. I was listening to your episode where you're talking about, you know, the niche, like the businesses that are very unique to our dance world. You know, the wigs, hair, makeup, these mindset coaches, these physical trainers. I think that's so exciting that we now, in a sense, have more examples of, hey, here's what you can do if you still want to be involved with Irish dancing, but you don't want to
be a teacher necessarily or go into a show.
Yeah, or you don't want to stop, but you still want to be involved.
It's a good way to bring, you know, some people's education and passions together with Irish dancing too, you know, like, you know, how great would it be to be a personal trainer and have that great knowledge of how to train people, but then also I've done this Irish dancing thing my whole life. Like, this is something I can specialize in.
Yes.
It'd be really exciting. So, and I know you know, looking back for as many things that you didn't like about teaching, I know you have, you know, so much respect for Maureen, and I can imagine she was probably really influential in you becoming a TC.
Oh yeah. So I'm really glad you bring this up, and apologies if I get emotional already. So I will say I was very fortunate that when I started dancing, that I got to see some of the greatest teachers we will ever see. Maureen Hall, like Maureen McTaggart, Peggy McTaggart, Dennis Dennehy, Una Ellis, Peter Smith, you know, Ann Richens. You and I, like, are people, dancers our age, we got to dance among legends. We got to be in the presence of greatness with teachers like this. And oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Maureen Hall really was a very important person to me. Again, I'm crying right now. I will say this. I was never quite close with my grandparents. So Maureen Hall was kind of like my surrogate grandmother. She was at every competition I danced at. She was at every major. And so, yes, she was a huge influence. I tell people that, you know, it was Riverdance and Feet of Flames that inspired me to dance. But it was Maureen McTaggart that made me fall in love with dancing. So when I took my TC in February 2017, up in D.C., I said earlier I was super prepared. It went really well. I passed. And I actually found out that weekend I passed because one of the examiners had a bit, I was enjoying themselves at the bar and let slip to me and another one of the candidates that we passed. So I was able to, but I didn't find out until after, kind of like a few little after that. But anyway, after I was done with the exam, I had messaged Pat Hall, Maureen's daughter, to let her know how the exam went, what dance, what I had to teach, how the written went. And so she told her mom, it's like, oh, Jason did well, he passed. And shortly after that, that's when Maureen Hall passed away. So the last thing she got to hear was that her world champion passed his TC. And this is something I have not told a lot of people, but when Maureen McTaggart passed away, a big part of me died in my relationship with Irish dancing. Because I did not really know a dance career without Maureen Hall.
Right, she was there that first day.
Yeah, exactly. And I really, and as you can see, I'm crying right now. It's I just really struggled to kind of find a way, like a part. It was hard for me to enjoy Irish dancing and not have the biggest influence of my life there anymore. And I really felt lost for a while with dancing. And I think now, you know, if I were to come back, I know how to forge a path of my own, knowing like and letting myself be my own leader. It was hard. It still is hard. I miss her every single day. I mean, I look at the awards hanging in my room. I look back on what I've done, and it really was because she was one of the best teachers, and I'm just very grateful for her.
It's beautiful. I mean, and a lot of people are going to resonate with that type of relationship that they've had either with their own dancing teacher or someone like Maureen, who is no longer with us, but was that driving force and that like comfort behind their dancing. You know, and a lot of us are really close with our teachers. Like when we're dancers, we travel to competitions with them, or, you know, like I think a lot of people are going to listen and it's either going to bring back memories or they have that person that immediately springs to mind. And I think we should dedicate this episode to her.
I agree. And yes, it's, as teachers, you know, we care about our students and our teachers cared about us. We want the best for all of our students, and that's, you know, our teachers want the best for us when we were dancers. And yet they see us through everything, those highs, the lows. They see us at our worst, they see us at our best. And, you know, to always just have them there by your side. And it's just hard losing people in general. But yeah, I think it's a very special relationship that dancers have with their teachers, especially, you know, ones that, you know, you become close to, or just, you know, the teachers that, you know, care so much about their students being successful in their own way. And again, I was very privileged that Maureen McTaggart Hall was that person for me. And again, just, you know, all those for everyone else, yes, just take that moment, you know, if your teachers are still with you, thank them, but also just tell them how much you appreciate them or how much you love them. Because trust me, even when they're screaming at you for overcorrection, they still very much care about you. And just to be reminded that you as a student, that you appreciate them, that really means a lot.
Do you have anything that Maureen, you know, taught you or instilled in you that you like think about or use still in your daily life?
most everything was always dance related. So not so much my day-to-day life, but you know, there are some things she said that stuck with me for so long. One of my favorite was, if you don't kick your seat, I'll kick it for you. because she was always big about backlift and something else, like she used to say, you have to be clear to the dumbest judge.
I might write that on our mirror tonight.
It's just for what, because she meant that your dancing had to be so clean and so good that there was never any question of doubt that you made a mistake or that you had an error. Or she once said during a class, like, no pussyfooting around. I don't recall what was going on. It was so funny. Oh my God, actually one of my favorite interactions. It was during a summer workshop. Peggy McTaggart was still with us. And so it's Maureen and Peggy. So Peggy was the older sister. And you know, Peggy, she like won like 3 All-Ireland titles. Actually, when Peggy won the All-Ireland, she won like 3 years in a row and got to keep the cups back then. If you won 3 times. Yeah. So, you know, amazing dancers. So imagine a room full of, you know, like tweens and teens, you know, this is a summer workshop. And you have these 2 little old Irish ladies arguing about traditional sets. It was so funny. They were literally arguing like what was the correct movement and what wasn't. And so you have Maureen was like, Peggy, I know what I'm talking about. And Peggy's like, I danced the damn thing. I know what I'm talking about. Oh, so funny. It's one of my favorite memories.
And that was like, you know, during the good old days where you could, you know, like speak like that and like say those types of things in front of like rooms of children, you know?
Oh my God. Yeah. It's crazy. I think we've all as teachers have accidentally sworn in front of a student that we don't want to, but yeah, some of those little old Irish teachers I learned a lot of words.
Yep. And that's the thing. We just, you know, let it go because they were just colorful Irish women and you just let them say what they want.
Oh yeah.
And I know you had, you know, some other like just funny stories or funny, you know, memories of your Irish dance career. So if you had to pick a couple to share with the listeners.
Yes. So I think we've all as dancers have been in that situation where you either have to, you kind of like your mind goes blank and you had to make up something on stage or you stop. I once stopped at an Oireachtas and I still won.
Oh, interesting. How did you pull that off?
Yeah. Oh, and this made a lot of people angry and rightfully so. But here's how it went. It was the 2007 Southern Oireachtas in Atlanta. For some reason, I was just like in a really bad headspace. I was just steady, really nervous. I still to this day, I don't know why. I was just in my head and creating problems that didn't exist. So I'm on stage dancing my jig. And I remember the way my middle step started was kind of like, I started like on a half beat. It's kind of like a tricky rhythm right there at the beginning. And I start into it, but then I start doing my last step and I just stopped. It freaked me out. And so I danced for a few bars, stopped, walked over to the other side of the stage and then picked back up where, like on the left of it. And mortified, could not believe it. And that also just happened to be the day, like things just kind of kept getting bad. Like, so my reel was okay. Going for my set and I was doing Garden of Daisies at 76. The musician starts playing and he's playing it too fast. So I like starting like barely a couple bars and I stop him. I'm like, that music's way too fast. And again, mind you, I already stopped dancing earlier in the day. I'm already feeling stressed out. And Rose Fearon was one of my judges. She gets up from her table, walks over to the musician and starts banging out the writ, like the timing so that he can play it correctly. And I'm like, this day is sucks so much. I was not expecting to win, but I did. And the reason for that is because it was It was a rotating panel of three, so nine judges total. According to the rules, because I did not stop, I stopped for less than eight bars of music, so you're not awarded 0 points, you're just awarded last place. So yeah. I still received points, and you know, this is a boys competition. It was small enough. I think the last place was like seventh, but I won the other two rounds with perfect scores. And so the math worked out that I still won, and people were upset, rightfully so. I don't blame them. It's not, I can look back and now I'm like, that is incredible that I stopped and still won, but do not recommend it. Do not recommend it. And I think they actually might have changed the rules to say, you know, if you stop dancing, regardless of how many bars of music, it's a zero.
Now, before we started recording the show, I remember you talking about how you felt like there might be different rules for world champions. Is this one of those scenarios?
Yes and no. And so I'm really kind of glad that you brought this back up. And in that situation, in your episode, when somebody had asked you, you know, what's your ideal judging panel?
Yeah.
And you said, you know, for the best dancer in the overall competition, a set panel
for this reason.
Kind of, yeah, for like a like kind of fairness, rotating. And I'll say this, I've benefited from both. I've won with rotating panels. I won all three, like I won my All Ireland. Actually, I won four main major titles. I won with a set panel, and my last rules was to drop at the high and the low. But in that situation, no, I think just because it was an Oireachtas, and I think there's some leniency. But again, I technically didn't break the rules at the time,
yeah.
Where it said stopping for, if you stop for less than eight bars, is a last place, not 0 points. But yes, I actually would have to say I think the rules are different for top dancers. Case in point, I have seen this video, and I'm not going to say who this dancer is, but this is a numerous time world champion. She's dancing, I think it's from like it's from the Great Britain. And it's her hornpipe lead. And y'all, if you pay attention, she does the ending on the right foot, then she does the ending on the right foot again, but should be the left. And you know, with the rights of Fesh TV, we heard about that one dancer who completely false started, gets third, and then has those scores rescinded.
Yeah.
Yes, I think judges sometimes are okay to be a bit more lenient for those top dancers, knowing that, you know, is the dancer talented? Absolutely. But sometimes I feel judges have that pressure that they don't want to be that person to tank a well-respected dancer, or the fears of affiliation that if you give a dancer such and such place, that teacher can retaliate, whether in business or in scoring. And I feel, you know, even with the cheating scandal bringing to light kind of an open secret that we are all aware of, there's still that fear. And it is, I think, incredibly unfair. Now, I'm not going to lie, I probably have benefited at times, I'm sure, out of Fesh, where, you know, I really didn't dance well, I still won, maybe even at a major. Yeah, it might not have been like a best round, but a judge might still give me, you know, a bit more points just because of who I am or just what I've done. It's unfair. I mean, I could just be completely speaking my own opinion, but I think a lot of dancers might be able to relate to say they have noticed that some dancers seem to do well regardless.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think there's probably different opinions and perspectives and arguments for both, where, you know, you've probably also experienced where you might have felt like you were held to a higher standard because you were, you know, world champion in big bold letters,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then also the places where it's like, oh, well, it's the world champion, so we'll let it slide.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. And I'm sure, and I will say this, there are a lot of honest judges. I know sometimes it feels like there aren't, but there are a lot of very fair and honest judges who are judging dancers on the day.
Yep.
They don't care how you did at the Fesh last week. They don't care how you did at the major a few months ago. Even if you are the world champion and you aren't dancing well today, they're going to award you as such. I actually have much respect. Russell Beaton, one of my favorite people in the world, he's an 80 SD. He has told me, he's like, Jason, if I ever judge you at a major, I'm going to judge you how you're dancing on that day. Just because I know you personally, I'm not going to give you extra points. And he has always awarded me a touch. He's only judged me twice. And both times he did give me the 100, but that's because on the day I really did dance well. And he told me, he's like, you earned my 100.
Yep. He made you earn it.
Oh, incredibly. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you so much for, you know, choosing this platform to share more about your story and, you know, what you're up to these days and just how you've been able to make peace with how Irish dancing fits into your life now, because I think it's something that current dancers, current teachers, pretty much anyone who's still related to our wonderful, crazy world of Irish dance might need to hear.
Yes, thank you for having me. My journey is, it's unique to me, but I think hopefully a lot of people can relate that, Irish dancing is a big part of our lives, and, being, I guess I was considered one of the top dancers, and it's okay to be, like, to be yourself outside of Irish dancing. I mean, I did struggle always being Jason Hayes, the world champion, Jason Hayes, the Irish dancer. So to suddenly find out, like, who am I without dance being attached to it, it was hard, and it's not going to be easy. But for everyone that is going through that, it's okay. You are going to struggle. You are going to feel lost, but that's how everyone's feeling. But I would just say is, for people that are dealing with that, focus on what does make you happy. Focus on the things that you've been hesitant to try or couldn't try because, you're going to practice every other day. I mean, for myself, people see I'm at the gym all the time. It's actually, I was joking about this to somebody. There's this weird Irish dance to bodybuilding CrossFit.
There really is.
It's so interesting. I think as in dancing, our upper bodies are so small. So we're trying to overcorrect it now because our legs are so big.
But I think this is just my personal theory is, there's goals and, you always want to go up in a different, get a new personal best. And there's sequence to weight training in a similar way that there kind of is to Irish dancing, getting to the next level or getting, my next best result. And I don't know if that's anything to do with it, but I think it makes it an appealing choice to an Irish dancer. It's active and it keeps you, fit and strong and all that, of course, too.
Completely agree. No, I completely agree. Yeah, there are attainable goals, and hey, if I put in this much work, I will achieve this goal, which is, things we learn from Irish dancing. If I practice this long, or I focus on this correction and really improve upon that, then I will start seeing the outcome that I so want.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, we do. We know that you love to lift. What else? Who else is Jason Hayes these days?
So I work in marketing. So that's kind of my other thing is after dancing, I got a college degree in communication and really have been focusing on marketing strategy and analytics. So I am a sucker for a good spreadsheet and a good database. I really like numbers. Right now doing that, I'm at the gym all the time. I actually just hit a personal best of a 900 pound belt squat, which the legs are still legging thanks to Irish dancing. But other than that, it's enjoying being an adult, and as an adult, able to just go to concerts, go out with my friends, just do things. But sometimes I just enjoy being lazy, just staying at home, not doing anything. Something else I kind of had to really get comfortable with was you don't always have to have some crazy hobby. You don't have to always be doing something
to the
weirdly
extreme.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm just enjoying life. I'm happy with my job, just with my day-to-day things, going to the gym, being with my friends. And it's just those simple things that I'm just enjoying. And as far as dancing, I still have a lot of friends in the Irish dance world. I'll be at the Nationals here in Grapevine. I've already been invited to go to the Aroctus, the Southern Aroctus that's in Orlando in December. I'll be glued to Fesh TV for the All Irelands and the world. So I'm still not involved with dance professionally, but I still enjoy watching all our sport, this sport. Oh, and I'll also, of course, the Olympics are going to be on later this year. So I'll also be glued to that. That's the other thing. I'm a huge Olympics fan.
That's so good. Yeah, I mean, and I'm sure you probably can relate to this as another early 30 something where it's like you're always evolving and changing. And every time you think you figured out who you are, you learn something else about yourself. And I think it's just important in general to know that like we're always growing and changing. There will always be struggles. There will always be setbacks, but you also always, you know, persevere and get through it. So
I agree. I agree. Couldn't have said it better.
So thank you again for coming on the show. I think this is going to be a much loved episode. And I don't know. We'll definitely catch up in Grapevine.
Oh, for sure. And Courtney, thank you so much for having me. A big fan of the podcast. And also for all you first time listeners, highly recommend listening to some of Courtney's previous episodes. I personally loved the ADCRG Q&A. I think that was fantastic. I even learned a lot listening to that. But also shout out to Una Harrigan for telling me to check you out and to get me on the show. And also shout out to Scott Doherty. I really enjoyed his episode. I think he's a great example for anyone listening to understand, you know, how, if you are struggling with a mindset or trying to get into a better mindset, listen to his episode. I've had great talks with him where, yeah, he didn't get better until he was much older. And for some of us, I was lucky that I kind of figured out early on, but that's not everyone. But yeah, Courtney, thank you so much. Big fan of the podcast, and we're looking forward to all the future episodes.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on TCRG to CEO Radio.